Welcome to the Oxford Education Deanery Podcast. In this series, we explore the latest research from the Department of Education at the University of Oxford and discuss the real-world implications for teachers, parents, and policymakers.
Hello and welcome to the Oxford Education Deanery Podcast. My name is Hamish Chalmers and I'm joined by Johnny Tridgell, a religious studies teacher with a long-standing connection with the department. Hello, Johnny.
Hello.
And Michelle Meadows, an Associate Professor of Educational Assessment here at the department. Hello, Michelle.
Hiya.
We're releasing this podcast on the eve of A-Level Results Day. Students and their teachers will be anxiously waiting to find out how they have done, keeping their fingers crossed that they will have attained the grades that they need to go on to the next stages of their lives, be that undergraduate study at university, study for a higher technical qualification, a degree apprenticeship, or into the workplace. Teachers will be getting ready to congratulate those who get the grades they need to progress and to support those students who don't do as well as they'd hoped. I remember the big day myself. I went into school to collect the results, put the small manila envelope with my results in it into my pocket, and then walked in ever-decreasing circles around Oxford city centre for a couple of hours until I'd built up the nerve to open it to learn how well I'd done. Like most people, hoping to head to university, I had to attain specific grades. So while I was building up that nerve, the question in my head was, have I done enough? Had I managed to land in the grade boundaries that would allow me to go on to the place that I had my heart set on? Like me at the time, students and teachers today often have questions about how grading works. What's the difference between an A star and an A, for example? Or are grade boundaries for different subjects set differently? Is a B in geography worth the same as a B in chemistry, for example? Or if I have an identified special educational need, is this taken into account when settling on my final grade? And so on. Michelle has a wealth of experience through her earlier work at Ofqual and AQA, where she was responsible for the grading, and as a researcher in educational assessment on how grade setting is achieved. And Johnny, also marked for AQA, and as a teacher, knows what it's like to be supporting pupils through the process. He knows all of the questions teachers and students have. So we thought that this would be an ideal moment to explore some of those questions and demystify for our listeners how it all works. Johnny, what do you think the biggest question for teachers and students is about grade boundaries?
I suppose the simplest and biggest one is how are they actually set? So I think there's lots of myths. We talk about norm referencing, which I think isn't true. And it'd be interesting to know how the grade boundaries are actually put in place by the exam boards.
Michelle, can you tell us about that?
Sure. It's important to appreciate the difference, first of all, between marking and grading. And I say that just because people often do mix up the two terms. So setting the grade boundaries happens once virtually all of the marking is done. It happens for each individual subject. And it's done by what's called an awarding committee. So this is a group of senior examiners. There'll be a chair of examiners, and there'll be the principal examiners who actually wrote each of the question papers. And normally there's a subject manager from the awarding body, the exam board, and there'll be a technical person there who is in charge of statistical information. So they get together and they're looking at the quality of the student work, but they're doing so also bearing in mind lots of statistical information. In the UK, this technique where you're mixing the examiner judgment of work and the stats is actually called attainment referencing. So it's not norm referencing, that is sometimes mixed up. And depending on how confident you are in the statistics or in the examiner judgment, the balance between the two in deciding the boundaries shifts. For example, if you've got an entirely new qualification, then it's really hard for the examiners to judge what is the quality of work, a particular grade, that's going to maintain the standard over time. So in that scenario, you're really reliant on statistical information to help you judge where to put the boundary. And when you're in sort of steady state and you've had a qualification for many years and perhaps, you know, you've got a really large entry to your qualification, then obviously the stats are pretty good then and you can rely on them a bit more. And that's really the strength of the approach that we have in this country, that this kind of mix of examiner judgment and stats that, you know, you can play in depending on how confident you are.
So does that mean that when we talk about norm referencing, does that mean that it's not a question of you just got to get above 70% to get an A? Is that how it works, that it's actually a bit more complicated than that?
Yeah, so norm referencing is actually a very particular approach that in my research, I've never found an example of a qualification rather than a test that is norm referenced. Mm-hmm. So norm referencing, the best example of this is IQ tests. IQ tests are norm referenced. That's where you go and you get a representative sample of your population. You do a norming study with them. Then the test never changes. It's kept steady. And you're constantly referencing the results of the test group back to the norm that you originally tested. Mm-hmm. We don't do that, do we, at all, when it comes to A-levels or indeed GCSEs. And so I think what people mean when they say, oh, this might be norm-referenced, is, as you say, a particular percentage of the population is always awarded the same grade. Actually, if you look at individual subjects and the results for each individual A-level subject, you can see that's not the case because they do bob up and down a little bit over time. Although, because we do use statistics in the grade boundary setting process to a great extent, you can see that once all the subjects are brought together and you look at the national outcome of all the A-levels, they're pretty steady from one year to the next.
So if, for example, you've got a really tricky paper one year, and then the year before the paper felt a bit more straightforward, how would you make that so that was fair across both years with the grade boundaries?
This is the strength of the approach that's taken, because you're absolutely right that no matter how hard a senior examiner tries, it's really difficult to write a paper that's exactly the same level of demand as the one sat in the previous year. It's really tough. So you've got to set your grade boundaries such that if you've got a hard paper, they need to be slightly lower. If you've got an easier paper, they need to be slightly higher to be fair to the students. And so this is where the examiners looking at the quality of work try and bear that in mind, but it's incredibly hard for them. Everything is changing. Your questions are changing. The paper's different. Your entry is changing a little bit. So you need to know a bit about your entry. So these students who have entered this year, are they more or less academically able than in previous years? You want to know that, don't you? So this is where the stats come in. So you can find out, for example, at A level, what was the mean GCSE score of all of these students that have entered this year? And how does that compare to the previous year? Are they more academically able or less academically able? That information, along with things like the mark distributions and the means and standard deviations of the papers, and of course the actual student work, all of that information is brought together to enable them to just tweak the boundaries up or down according to how hard or easy the paper is.
So when it finally comes down to it, then, so we've got this committee that is sitting there. Who makes the final call and like, right, this is the mark, this is what the A is, this is what the E is? Who makes that final decision?
Yeah, great question. So there are multiple levels of sign-off. Initially, it's the chair of examiners. So the chair will really try and work hard with the committee, with all the information that they're given, to come to a consensual decision about where the boundaries are. Once that's happened, then there's a level of sign-off within the exam board, as you can imagine. And there can be different levels, actually, depending on which exam board. So often there'll be an initial level where somebody quite technical will really delve into the examiner's reports, the boundaries that have been chosen, all the information, and they'll be asking themselves, does this look plausible? Does this look right? And hopefully they'll say yes and sign it off. And then it will go usually to the responsible officer of the exam board, who is responsible for the maintenance standards. And they will then ask exactly the same kinds of questions. You know, do I have confidence confidence in this award. They will hopefully sign it off. And then, of course, we have an exams regulator, whether you're in any jurisdiction in the UK, there'll be an exams regulator. They will then also scrutinise the outcomes from the award. And again, they'll be asking themselves, does this look right? Can I have confidence in this? And if the exams regulator thinks, this looks a bit fishy, they will ask some challenging questions. How did you come to this set of grade boundaries and these outcomes? And then there'll be a conversation that goes on. And of course, the exam board normally has a brilliant rationale. Of course they do. And they have lots of evidence. But that challenge will happen. So there are a number of points at which there's no sense in which the exams regulator signs off boundaries. That's not the case. The boundaries are very much owned by the exam boards, but there's that challenge there.
Sounds like a very sort of multi-layered, or at least a lot of checks and balances go through. So does this give us confidence that by the time the results are released, that it's really been sort of well scrutinised and that everyone is very happy with the results as they've been presented?
Yeah, absolutely. That's not to say that there haven't been occasions when things have gone wrong. Just look back to GCSE English in 2012. There are problems then with the grading. But generally speaking, we can have a lot of confidence that the boundaries have been very carefully selected.
Great. Now, you mentioned a little bit earlier about the entries, the students taking the A-levels themselves. So I want to move on to talk about the potential implications of the people taking the exam. So if a student has, for example, access arrangements, does that affect the grade that they get? Or what about if they have other kinds of special considerations? My particular area of interest in research is children for whom English is an additional language. Mm-hmm. And so often they get accommodations through the process of taking the exam, like extra time, for example, or an amanuensis for somebody who's not able to write themselves. Does this make a difference?
Well, all of the special arrangements that are put in place occur at the time of the assessment. So the grade boundaries themselves are not adjusted at that later point. So the idea is that by putting in place access arrangements, students are able to show what they can do. Now, there is a slight anomaly in the sense that sometimes special consideration is applied. So special consideration is where perhaps there was a temporary kind of issue where perhaps a student had something really quite awful happen to them the day before the exam. And then there can be an arrangement made where a small proportion of additional marks are given. But that's actually the stage of marking. But the grade boundaries themselves are not adjusted. All the activities to try and ensure fairness are put in at the front end of the process.
So by the time the exam board has marked the papers and they're starting to set the grade boundaries, then all of those differences in the people taking the exams have essentially been sort of accounted for.
Well, that's certainly the aim, yes.
So I think when you're thinking about the work that happens at the end then with the grade boundaries, the assumptions, and you're looking at, right, we've decided that, let's say, 60 out of 100 is a B. What happens when you're looking at that in terms of student groups? Is there a sense of actually, we'll just say, well, if we put it at 60, that means X number of children have got a B. If we put it at 61, that number drops. How much does that drop? Is that something that's considered? And then is it also, I suppose, in addition to that, are you aware of things like student ethnicity or gender, for example, when you're making those calls about it's going to be 60 or 61 and what that would mean for those student populations? Or is that information kind of hidden from you?
So while you're setting the boundaries, you're absolutely thinking about what does this mean in terms of the proportion of students getting a particular grade. That's really at the forefront of everybody's mind. However, it would be very unusual for an exam board to include information about, you know, the protected characteristics of the students at this point. Mm. So what should happen is that those considerations occur much, much earlier in the process. So in selecting the questions, the way in which they create the assessments, then they should be absolutely thinking, what does this mean for students of different ethnicity? What does it mean for boys versus girls? And so on. So that kind of fairness should be really at the forefront of their minds. Then, after grading has occurred, there will be lots of analyses of how the question paper performed and how different groups performed. And, you know, there'll be an opportunity there for doing what's called differential item functioning, which is where you look at, did male students do better than female students on this item, considering how they do on the test overall? That kind of analysis. So the thinking goes on much earlier in the process and then much later in the process, rather than it being something that's particularly taken into account at the point of setting the grade boundaries.
So it's much more about the actual paper itself and the access arrangements, and I suppose the training for the markers and all that kind of end of things, as opposed to what's happening in the grade committees.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that has been discussed over the years in the research literature. Would it be right to consider the outcomes for different groups? Should we, in the statistics that we use in the awarding meetings, actually put in these different characteristics and have them as part of the statistical modelling?
And I think it's interesting looking at contextual offers for university, for example, that universities might give a student with certain characteristics or from a certain type of school a lower offer, for example. And I wonder if that's something that would ever be possible to do contextual grade boundaries.
Well, there's a great research paper by Dr. Neil Stringer that actually explores exactly that possibility. Mm. So, you know, what you could do is you could have the standard grades as we have in any normal year, and then you could actually create contextual grades, and you could do this rather than each individual university doing it for themselves, you know, to contextualise their admissions process. You could do this at, you know, a national level at perhaps, you know, it could be something that the regulator did. I'm not sure they'd necessarily want that job, or it could be something that the exam board did. Mm. I think this is, you know, it's interesting, but it's also very, very controversial whether or not this kind of information should be included or not. It's very values driven. And, you know, just over recent years, I've been watching with great interest the changes in attitudes towards standardized assessment in the US, where they're really pushing towards a much more socio-culturally responsive approach to assessment. Actually, different assessments for different groups. Mm. So rather than contextualizing grades, actually changing the assessments so that two groups could sit quite different assessments. And here, particularly in England, we're still quite in the standardisation framework where our notion of fairness is that everybody gets the same examination. And these are competing versions of what is fair.
Mm.
Fairness is one of those very complex concepts.
Yeah, we certainly hear in the EAL, the English as Additional Language world, the idea that what would be the implications of doing first language assessments of core content to allow children to demonstrate if their strongest language is not English, their content knowledge. So, you know, if you may be a brilliant scientist in Ukrainian, but asked to demonstrate that through English might make it look like you're not quite so good at science or whatever. So I think it opens up a really interesting conversation, but it also seems to open up a bit of a can of worms, because if you're going to do, how do you ensure that each of those different language assessments would be similarly pitched, the same level of difficulty or so on? But it certainly is an interesting...
Yeah, and there's a lot of research on that as well, how to create comparable assessments in different languages very tricky.
I think it's interesting in English, isn't it? Just seeing the impact it's had on students just when a command word in an exam question is one they're not familiar with. Mm. And it's kids whose English is a first language and it's just quite a vocabulary word they've not heard before, or they've not understood, and how you adjust for that. But I guess it's when you come back to this thing about setting the grade boundaries, using the statistics and trying to recognise what's gone wrong. Mm. If suddenly you've got a whole group of children who've just misunderstood the question completely.
A few years ago, I remember there being a controversy over a question that had asked the exam sitters to compare two things. And there was a semantic difference between compare and contrast. And some children had done both. They had compared and contrasted. Other children had taken the question at its word and just compared, i.e. seen what's similar about the two things. And so there was this big controversy over whether they had been disadvantaged by the ones who had faithfully answered the question with reference to its sort of exact semantic meaning, and those who had gone the extra mile to take into account contrasting as well as comparing. Mm. And so those things, I imagine that statistical analysis is something which would be sort of after the fact would be helpful in terms of identifying, as you say, Johnny, where it might have gone wrong. But also looking at those protected characteristics and so on, maybe looking and seeing whether there are things that we need to be doing with it within our teaching. So does that make these sort of essentially summative assessments like A-levels and GCSEs, does it introduce a formative aspect to them? So in as much as we can see that there is an issue here with a particular group over addressing that area of the curriculum, so therefore we can make curricular changes or pedagogical changes to help address that.
Yeah, and so examiner reports come out after each exam series where the chair of examiners, working with their colleagues who set the papers, will set out where there have been misunderstandings, where perhaps an area of the curriculum hasn't been taught or learned as well as they would really hope, and where there's been success too.
Mm. I guess following on from that, I suppose, going back to what you were saying earlier about the committees and everyone's involvement there, this thing about how the questions are phrased is really interesting. So I teach A-level RS, I've taught both OCR and AQA. The question styles are very different. So the AQA is very kind of regimented, very similar every time. OCR, much more variable. But OCR, you get a choice of questions, AQA, you don't. What also, I suppose, quite interesting for teachers, certainly for me, if I'm trying to pick a spec, there's always that idea, or when you talk to people about it, is one paper easier to get an A in, but that one's easier to get an E in. Those kind of ideas we have. And I wonder, first of all, how much of that is just a myth and we're just talking unnecessarily about things that aren't really true, but also how you standardise that across the exam board. So actually an A grade in OCR, philosophy and ethics, is the same as an AQA one. So they're worth the same, because I think that's what people worry about a lot when they're making decisions about what exam board to go with. How do I make it fair? And is there any sense that one year it might have been easier to get an A if you'd done this paper versus that board?
Oh, that's such a good question. I'm fascinated by this because I've done this work for a long, long time now. And I sort of look back to, you know, over 20 years ago when I first started working in the field. And actually, there were much, much greater differences then between the offer of different exam boards. So, you know, you would have one exam board offering a modular specification, another offering linear. One might have some coursework, the other might be entirely examined. And now, actually, there is a far higher level of similarity between the offers, and yet still people are concerned that there might be issues of comparability. Mm. The way in which the awarding works is, and this is where the stats really do come in, because this is the way in which the standards between exam boards are aligned. Given the mean GCSE profile of each exam board's entry, a prediction is given as to what the A-level outcomes should look like. So if one exam board, say OCR, attracts an entry with, say, lower mean GCSE scores and another example, say, Pearson attracts an entry in a particular subject that's got higher GCSE scores, then the prediction of how those students should perform in each of the exam boards is adjusted. And this is what the regulator looks at. So the regulator will be looking at, has each of the exam boards come relatively close into prediction? And clearly, if one exam board is sticking out, then questions will be asked that have to be a really great rationale, because the exam regulator would be asking, why is it that all the students in this particular exam board have done so much better this year? It's not a national phenomenon. We're not seeing it in the other exam boards. Mm. So what's going on here? So questions would be asked. So it's through the use of these statistical predictions that we're able to keep some of the benefits of having different exam boards where you can actually make choices. Mm. And frankly, if you're unhappy with the level of service that you've had, you can change exam board and yet still get comparability of the grades that are actually awarded.
So if I'm sort of thinking of switching my GCSE spec or my A-level spec, would you say it's probably not worth worrying too much about what the grade boundaries are in across specs when I'm making that decision? I should focus more on just which content do I like. Is it?
Absolutely that. Yeah. So I wouldn't be looking at the grade boundaries, because if you see that one exam board's got lower grade boundaries, that's probably because they've got harder paper.
Right.
What I'd be thinking about is, what do I enjoy teaching and what are my students interested in? What's going to play best for them?
I think that's really interesting, because I think when I have conversations with teachers and heads of department about what specification they picked, it's interesting how many people do it based on the paper and the grade boundaries. Again, because I suppose we're so focused on wanting to get the best possible outcome for the children. And I wonder if maybe we need to reframe that a little bit as a profession and say, actually, this will even out. That bit isn't the important bit. It's the other end.
Yeah. Have a look at the question papers. Have a look at the spec. Yeah. But I wouldn't worry too much about the grade boundaries themselves, because give with one hand, take away with the other. Yeah. Hard paper, but low boundaries.
Mm. Yeah. So it's not necessarily an easy win of, I'll just look at the grade boundaries and go, that's interesting.
Very good. You spoke there about prediction. And prediction from GCSE to what one might expect at A level. So I just want to take another a different look at prediction, and that's the use of mock exams. And so are teachers, should they take into account the grade boundaries, or what grade boundaries should they use when conducting mocks, where in some cases you won't be doing a whole paper, you might only be doing a part of a paper?
This is really tricky, isn't it? Because we've just talked about how difficult it is to set a paper that's got the same demand. Mm-hmm. And that's because even very small changes to questions can really impact on student performance. So just a shift in wording, a different set of numbers in a maths question can really, really change how hard students find the paper. Of course, teachers want to use grade boundaries. I think they just have to be very mindful of the fact that they're just an approximation. So, you know, if you're going to use half a paper, the obvious thing to do is just half the grade boundary. But you don't know, do you? Is that the easier half or the harder half? You don't know. So inevitably, you're going to want to do it. Mm. But I would just bear in mind the uncertainty and that they're very, very approximate.
So if I was to say to you, then the way that I would do my grade boundaries would be to take, I think last time I did it, took an average of both papers for A-level over 2018 and 2019, and then gave myself a score out of 200, so it's out of 200 the paper, based on all those averages over two papers over 2 years, and then just divvy that up. So if I mark a 25-mark question, I just do whatever proportion that is of the mark and say that's what the B is, and then usually round up if it's a fraction. I think it's those sort of maths that we're all doing as teachers, trying to come up with something that feels reasonable. I used to do a really basic 10% grade boundary, and that was an absolute nonsense. I think, is that a good way to go, or is it all just shooting in the dark?
Well, it's certainly a better way to go than 10%. Look, you know, that sounds reasonably sensible. I think you just have to bear in mind that you're not really sure.
Mm.
And so then it becomes about how you're using those outcomes and what the students believe about those outcomes. Because students need to feel, need to know that they can nonetheless do well.
Mm.
And it's about the washback of those outcomes on their motivation. So I'm sure teachers are very careful about how they then encourage students to...
Yeah, so it's not just saying you've got an A all year. It's you've got an A using these boundaries that I have artificially generated, I suppose, isn't it? But I guess I suppose the real scary thing, particularly at A level, is that we use these to do their UCAS predictions. You know, with the death of ASs, that becomes scarier, doesn't it? If we're saying actually the grey boundaries stop being a kind of, oh, this is an interesting thing for us to think about, but really let's talk about focus on how you can improve. To like actually the grade I'm going to give you in November of year 13 is a life-changing one in terms of your options. And that, I guess, is the scary bit, isn't it?
That's why when you look at UCAS predictions, they tend to be really quite generous. So about, I think it's around a third of UCAS predictions about a grade too high. A small proportion are too severe. And that's because, understandably and rightly, really, given the uncertainty, teachers are given the benefit of the doubt in those. That makes sense, doesn't it? I would do exactly the same thing if I was in that position.
I think it's interesting, I think, just that bit about how you make that call, but also recognising, as you say, that the call is always a guess and based on a tiny number of students. I mean, if you've got, particularly at A level, if you've got a class of 10 and you're trying to make some sort of decision when actually the actual data sets are thousands and thousands of marks, it's just not doable, is it?
Yeah, and for me, there's always a disconnect between this and, you know, when grade boundaries are set and we use predictions in that scenario, it's only when we've got more than 1,000 students that we start getting really confident about those predictions. We would never dream of generating predictions on, you know, less than fewer than 100 students. That would be madness, and certainly not for each individual student.
Yeah.
And yet, in another scenario, here we are expecting teachers to generate predictions.
We saw that all play out very, very sort of obviously during the pandemic years, didn't we, with the teacher what teachers were predicting against what the now infamous algorithm actually ended up giving.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of algorithms, do you think AI will come to play a role in this?
How interesting. Yeah. Well, I've just come back from a conference where I was discussing for a session that was all about using AI to mark.
Mm-hmm.
So where assessments don't change from one year to the next, unlike here where they're always changing, AI has been used for many years. And now there's the possibility of using generative AI, which is much speedier and it needs less training, even in scenarios like the UK where the questions are changing all the time. Because you don't have to train generative AI in quite the way that you do traditional AI. Having said that, we are years away from being in that position. But yeah, I can definitely see that there's a role for AI, not necessarily in first marking, but perhaps in quality assuring the marking that goes on. Mm. Is there a role for AI in the generation of grade boundaries? Wow, that's a really interesting idea. I mean, the bit that we really struggle with is this issue of comparing performances over time. Because obviously the statistics that we use tell us nothing about whether the actual student performance has got better or worse. It just tells us about who the cohort are. So whether there's a role for AI there in actually analysing the qualities of the scripts, well, that's a very exciting possibility, but we're a long way away from it.
And with lots of risks, I suppose, as well, of the way AI can reproduce bias as well. And I think sometimes that assumption that AI will do it neutrally is unhelpful as well, isn't it, actually?
Exactly.
So
people tend to think AI is going to make everything more efficient. Yeah, maybe. On the cost side, there's all the validation work really, really careful validation work that has to go on to, as you say, check the validity of the outcomes and look for bias in them. So although you're making a saving in one place, there's going to have to be a massive investment elsewhere to take real care over any potential use of AI.
Brave new world. Johnny, when the A-level results come in, I'm just now reflecting back on my moment when I picked up that manila envelope and then was too scared to open it. What's your experience of that with the young people that you work with? And what might happen if, in essence, they get the wrong grade, or they don't get the grade that you predicted, or they don't make the grades that they need to go to where they want to go next?
I've come at this from a few different angles. So I was head of sixth form for a long time. So we used to get the results the day before. So in that sense, you've sort of got your hat off, like, right, I know that this might not have gone well. There's discussions, there's plans in place. So it will depend what the school have got in place perhaps for that young person. If they know the results haven't got quite there, if they put some plans in place for what the conversation will be like. And then I've sort of just done it as a classroom teacher who doesn't have that extra knowledge of just being in the room on results day and seeing them open and basically just watching their faces and see what happens next. I think the wrong grade is brutal. I think that kind of what that means for that person. And it's always interesting to see, because I think sometimes it doesn't matter because they'll have already heard from UCAS, they've already been told they've got in, and they will be completely unbothered. They'll be upset about it later because they'll be like, I'm annoyed, but I got in, so I don't care. Like, that's fine. Mm. I think the bit when it's, I've got the wrong grade and that's changed my future, is really difficult. And I think for teachers is obviously difficult for us in a different way. It's not our lives that have been changed, but also there's a sense of feeling quite helpless to do anything about it. Mm. And I think also lots of worry about, is this my fault? Right. Have I done something? Did I teach this badly? Have I let this child down? And then have I ruined their life? Is this what's happened there? So I think there's a lot going on results day for teachers. Yeah. It's quite a roller coaster. You're very empathetic with the children. You know, you've got a kid celebrating, then you feel brilliant. If you've got a child crying in front of you, then that's obviously just heartbreaking. Yeah. And then also, yes, your own kind of emotional reaction of, oh, my class did really well, or, oh God, it all went horribly wrong. What happened? So I think there's a lot. And I think a key thing for me for results day, when I was head of sixth form or anything else, was desperately trying to stay calm.
Right.
And be kind of, right, we're going to be calm. We're going to help solve problems. We're going to talk people off ledges. We're going to make sure everything's okay. Yeah. But also recognising there's not that much power to do that.
Yeah, and that brings us to a question for Michelle. So given all of the work that goes into trying to be as fair as possible in setting grade boundaries and marking the work in the first place, is there any sort of avenue for children who, or young people who want to challenge the grade they've been given? Or is it so sort of meticulously done, there is no space for challenge?
Oh, look, assessment is never perfect. And, you know, we're talking there about getting the wrong grade. And you can get the wrong grade for all sorts of different reasons, mm-hmm. of course, because unfortunately some kids will just have a bad day. And in a way, they've got the wrong grade. You know, you might feel that as a teacher, yeah. and they may feel it because you know they could do better under different conditions. And that's really sad. And then there's, you know, the questions that come up on the day. Play to some people's strengths and not others. You know, assessment is an imperfect thing. But often what we're talking about really is where we think there's a problem with the marking. So something has gone wrong with marking, and then absolutely, then there is an opportunity to appeal and have the marking checked. And, you know, where we're talking about A-levels, they, you know, you can get that turned around really quite quickly so that, you know, the student can still go off to the university that they want to go to. We have a system where, for A-levels in particular, we have, you know, long essays, etc. There is room there for differences of opinion mm-hmm. that actually are entirely legitimate about the quality of the work. But there's also room for error. Right. And if there's a mistake that's happened, then, you know, getting the exam board to fix that mistake is really important. And that's what the appeal process is for.
Presumably that takes resources of some sort, if not time, then money? Do people have to pay to do this? Is there a difference between, for example, better resourced schools being able to, or more willing to challenge results than less well-resourced schools? Is there an issue around equity in that part of the process?
Yeah, I think there really is. It's one of these really wicked problems. The way it works is that if indeed the exam board finds that there is an error in the marking, even if it's just one mark, if there is an error, then you don't have to pay. Nonetheless, well-resourced schools are in a better position to be able to appeal more of their grades. And that feels dreadfully unfair. It is unfair. There have been conversations about whether it's right that anybody has to pay for their marking to be checked. The issue is, imagine the volume of appeals there would be if nobody had to pay.
If it was free, you'd get everybody challenging, right?
And then essentially what we'd be doing is remarking everything, reviewing everything rather, in a very short period of time. Mm. What's the quality of that process going to be like?
Yes.
If anybody's got any smart answers to this, that would be fantastic, because I think it is hugely problematic. It feels dreadfully unfair, but without any resource implication for the school or the family, then we would have a system where everybody, well, perhaps 90% of people would appeal, understandably, and then we'd just have second marking, and I'm not sure it'd be any better than the first marking.
I want to finish up now on research that's been done on this whole process. And I understand that you've been doing research with, is it Qualification Wales, on setting grade boundaries. So perhaps as a takeaway for our listeners, that you can tell us a little bit about the research that's been done on grade boundary setting and point people in the direction of any materials that they might want to follow up this podcast with.
Yeah, well, there's a huge history of research in this area into the quality of human judgment. You know, how good can an examiner be in terms of trying to identify exact mark that a boundary should lie on, and research into the quality of the statistics that's used as well. You know, what's the best kind of statistical information, and how should the two be blended? And actually, if you look around the world as well, there are different approaches to setting standards. So the approach that we use here is attainment referencing. It's got that blend of judgment and stats. Around the world, we see criterion reference systems that vary in terms of how strictly criterion reference they are. We see criterion referencing in vocational assessments. And we've already talked a bit about norm referencing. There are other approaches, such as cohort referencing, which is where a specific proportion of students are given a grade regardless of the particular entry for a subject. That's used around the world. So there are all these different approaches, and the particular piece of research that we did, funded by Qualification Wales, was to look at all of these different approaches, summarise their strengths and weaknesses. And actually, this was work focusing on GCSE rather than A-level. And it was essentially asking, if we were to take a different approach to standards, if we were to say it's criterion referencing for GCSEs, what would that mean for GCSEs? How would they be designed? How would each stage of the qualification life cycle look different if they were criterion referenced? What if we norm referenced? How would it look then? And that's been incredibly helpful, I think, because it just brings together what is a huge literature across many countries and asks that question. So you might be interested to know that GCSEs were originally intended to be criterion referenced.
Right.
However, it failed because of the sheer volume of criteria that had to be created for any particular subject and the level of specificity associated with each of these criteria.
So is criterion referencing a bit like when you do your driving test, like sort of tick off, you can do X, Y, and Z, therefore you get this?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. That's the idea behind it, that if we can just specify all of the criteria that a student has to meet to get a particular grade, And then it's normally based on teacher assessment, normally, rather than exams. And the teachers will judge, yes, this student can do this particular piece of maths. The problem is that actually, just because of the vagaries of language, specifying the criteria in such a way that teachers can apply them consistently is harder than you might imagine. So you get differences between schools, etc., which is why you end up with this massive volume of very, very specific criteria. And then that begins to have a washback on teaching and learning. So there's a little phrase I like, which is that the assessment becomes learning, assessment as learning. And that's what can happen.
I think anyone who's used a scoring rubric for anything will find that familiar. But we will link to that research in the show notes to this podcast. Before we sign off, anything that we've missed today?
No, I could talk about this forever.
So. Well, I reckon we'll have you on again for another conversation. I think that's a good place to leave it. So I just want to thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Johnny, very much for joining us today and sharing those valuable insights into the process of A-level grading. I want to finish by saying good luck to everyone getting their results tomorrow and to their teachers who will be supporting them through that. Or if you're listening to this podcast after the fact, I hope that you and your students got what you were hoping for. The future starts here.
Indeed.
You've been listening to the Oxford Education Deanery podcast. To find out more about the research featured in today's episode and everything else the Deanery has to offer, visit our website and sign up to our newsletter. You'll find the links in the show notes.